Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a Dhamma talk on the Rahulavada Sutta. In this sutta, the Buddha teaches his 7-year-old son the proper application of mindfulness. This talk includes Sangha Q&A and discussion and was recorded at Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey on October 8, 2016. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation. Thank you. Peace.
So the Rahulavada Sutta. In this sutta, the Buddha teaches mindfulness to his son. The Buddha's teachings of personal behavior are found in the virtuous factors of the Eightfold Path. Right speech, right action, and right livelihood can be summarized as remaining harmless and free of clinging, including clinging to views of a permanent self, in thought, word, and deed. The Buddha was sitting with his son Rahula, who was 7 at the time. The Buddha asked Rahula if he saw the few drops of water left in the ladle that the Buddha was holding. Rahula replied that he did. The Buddha tells Rahula, "That is how little understanding one has who tells deliberate lies." The Buddha then tosses away the few drops of water and tells Rahula, "A person who feels no shame in telling deliberate lies has tossed away their mindfulness." So I'm assuming that before this teaching began, the Buddha caught Rahula in a rather big lie. The Buddha then turns the ladle upside down and tells Rahula, "A person who feels no shame in telling deliberate lies has turned their mindfulness upside down." The Buddha then shows Rahula the empty ladle and says, "Whoever feels no shame in telling a deliberate lie is as empty and hollow as this ladle." So that's an interesting thing. If you think about the beyond the moral consequences of lying, if you're lying for any reason, it's to protect a self-referential ego self. It's there to protect what the Buddha said is not a self, anatta. And so it's obvious that person that you're attempting to protect is just a view, and it's empty of any reality, any real self. And that's where the Buddha is teaching his son that, using this great analogy. He goes on, "Anyone who feels no shame in telling deliberate lies is capable of any wrongdoing. Train yourself, Rahula. I will not tell a deliberate lie for any reason, even jokingly." The Buddha then asks Rahula if he knows what a mirror is for, and Rahula replies, "For reflection, sir." The Buddha responds, "In the same way, your thoughts, words, and deeds must be done with constant reflection." Another word for reflection is mindfulness. "Reflect in this manner, Rahula. Is this thought, word, or deed skillful? Will it lead to harm for yourself or others, or will it lead to release? Will this thought, word, or deed bring more suffering for myself or others, or will it have a peaceful result? If upon reflection your thoughts, words, and deeds will have peaceful results, then this is fit for you and fit for a person developing understanding." Rahula, all those who purify their minds through continual mindfulness will do so in just this way. Rahula, you should train yourself in just this way through continual mindfulness of your thoughts, words, and deeds. That's the end of the Buddha's words there. "Of course, it takes great wisdom developed through the Eightfold Path to completely understand all of the effects of our thoughts, words, and deeds. Mindfulness of thoughts, words, and deeds is supported by right view and right intention and deepens as concentration develops through right effort, right mindfulness, and right meditation." In other words, the entire Eightfold Path. "Even at a young age, Rahula was able to develop mindfulness of his thoughts, words, and deeds and actions and to develop heightened virtue. Rahula, guided by his father's wisdom and direct path to awakening, became a monk and in his lifetime put aside all clinging and awakened. To some, mindfulness of personal behavior, as behavior unfolds, seems too mundane to be of much importance. Analyzing behavior becomes more important than simple recognition and renunciation. Rituals, conceptual applications, and outer forms often are more appealing means of practice." Meaning, we get too analytical and we want to figure out where do these thoughts and where do these actions come from and what motivates them. And on one level, maybe that's useful. But as far as the Dhamma is concerned, what's most important is simply to recognize what's occurring. And if it's skillful, continue. And if it's unskillful, simply let it go. "Developing and occupying a view of what it means to be a Buddhist can be as empty and hollow as an empty ladle if the virtuous factors of the Eightfold Path are overlooked or diminished in importance. Mindfulness of thoughts, words, and deeds brings immediate understanding of clinging to objects and views. Mindfulness of clinging in the moment then brings the possibility of release, of unbinding, of full awakening. That's the end of the article. What each moment offers, the potential of each moment, is to do just what Buddha's teaching his son, to recognize our behavior in thought, word, and deed, and if it is in accordance with the Eightfold Path, continue to develop it and support it in any way you can. And if it's not, simply abandon it. We don't have to play around with it. We don't have to get down and dirty with it. We don't have to figure it out. Simply recognize what's skillful and let it go. Some people ask me, you know, how do I teach a young child? It comes up often. And I've had a few young people. I think the youngest was 10. So the way that I usually approach it with right speech, and I approach it this way, using either when you're telling a fib, look at how you feel. Does it make you feel comfortable or uncomfortable? And invariably, a young child will say, oh, yeah, I notice. That makes me feel uncomfortable. And so let it go. Another way I use it is if you notice when you're talking about your friends in a less than kind way, gossip, how does it make you feel? And invariably say, oh, yeah, it really doesn't make me feel good. And so they understand immediately that if it's not making you feel good, that's a good benchmark to recognize behavior that you want to let go of. And it doesn't have any far-reaching moral consequences. Of course, it does in application. But it's really recognize how you're dealing with how you're feeling with the way you're living your life. And your own agitated mind state can tell you what you want to let go of and what you want to hold on to. If it makes you uncomfortable, making you feel disconnected or agitated in any way, let it go. This simple teaching to Rahula was the foundation at 7 years old to develop full awakening. And it's hard to tell from the Pali Canon when that actually occurred for Rahula, but it was sometime in his early adulthood, you know, that he became a senior monk and was helping to teach others. So the Buddha got him started at a really early age, going in the right direction. But we can use that all the time. Just what are we holding in mind? You know, the essence of mindfulness as the Eightfold Path, as the Buddha teaches, is to be mindful of what's occurring right now. And then put whatever's occurring in our behavior in the context of the Four Noble Truths and in the framework of the Eightfold Path. And then we know how to proceed. We know how to continue our own awakening by being mindful of what we're doing right now. And that's really the essence of the teaching. So any questions about that simple teaching? Lorna?
It's kind of hard to maybe describe, but as I see myself, when I'm being mindful, I'm at home. I'm quiet and I can be more mindful at home. And when I'm outside the house, you know, just going about my, my chores, I'm not so mindful. And getting back to what you were saying about, you know, teaching children about how does it make you feel when you speak less than kind to other people, and you know you have that feeling. But when I'm out of the house, I'm also happy in a mindless way. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's not a skillful happiness. It's I just go with the flow, get caught up in the moment. You know, I might be in a restaurant or something, you know, and forget the whole Buddha thing. I'm just sitting in a restaurant having a good time. And I'm not mindful, and that's, I think, probably my problem, that I don't continue on with the mindfulness throughout my day. I'm kind of in and out. And going back to what you were saying about the child, how does it make you feel? Well, sometimes when I'm mindless, I feel very happy about it. I'm going the wrong way. You know what I mean?
I do.
The wrong way. But that's how I am.
That's how most people are. And so what you're talking about when you leave your house is the distraction that comes from being out
just
in the world. Very common.
Yeah.
It's one of the reasons why we meditate in solitude. You know, the Buddha's instructions to go find a root of a tree or an empty hut, meaning go find a way away from the distractions of the world where you can just be with yourself and with your thoughts and then deepen your concentration, develop samadhi. That's the foundation. And then off our cushion, he gave us an eightfold path because he realized that once we're off our cushion, our conditioned thinking is going to kick in. And we need a framework to see things clearly, beginning with right view. The first factor is the eightfold path. So when you walk out the door, you're losing your concentration.
Yeah.
Distraction occurs and you start becoming attracted to things.
Yeah.
And through that attraction, your senses fire and you have feelings of... I mean, one of the blissful feelings that a self-referential ego self develops is through distraction. In other words, the more distracted it becomes, the more happy it feels. But you describe that beautifully. You also recognize that that's mindless. Nothing. There's nothing wrong with it. There's nothing. It's not a moral question. It has to do more with skillfulness. Is my present level of mindfulness leading towards full human maturity, or is it going to continue confusion, delusion, and suffering? So taking delight in mindless actions is only going to further delusion, and it's good that you recognize it. That's the first step. A fully mature, fully awakened person who is settled in deep concentration will have the exact same experience. Your life will look the same on the outside, except you're maintaining your mindfulness. So you might be having a pleasant meal and you're enjoying the pleasant meal without the meal and the conversation being a distraction. You're able to see that situation through right view, through the framework of the Eightfold Path. You are acting in accordance with the moral and ethical factors, the virtuous factors. You're maintaining your concentration. You're maintaining your intention to recognize and abandon craving and clinging. But the first step is what you're describing, recognizing the difference. So you've developed enough of a concentration practice to see the difference. That's significant. That's important because you first have to see the difference before you can change anything. So I would bet that all of us have had that experience. We sit on our cushion, we become nice and well concentrated, we feel mindful. We get up off our cushion and the phone rings and it's an issue to deal with. We're immediately distracted. But as our practice deepens, as our concentration deepens and is supported then by the entire Eightfold Path, we're able to take that out into the world. And that's really the point. I know I say it a lot here, but the reason why the Buddha gave us an eightfold path and not a onefold path, meaning just meditation, is he recognized that common human problem of distraction by the outside world. When he awakened, you know, the famous pictures of Buddha sitting there with his left hand like this, and he touches the ground with his right hand, and what he says is, I have a long, rather long speech, but he concludes with, I have overcome the world. But what that means is that he has ceased being distracted by outside events. The world has lost its appeal as far as a distraction, and now he's able to live at peace continually with what the world throws at him. And the Buddha did not have, for 45 years, it wasn't just a blissful life sitting in, he was in some of the most difficult conflicts of his time, and help direct those conflicts back towards a more reasonable response to life. And he was always involved in that. But he ceased being distracted by what an ego would want in this situation and was able to maintain that mind of equanimity. So it's a great question. I hope I answered it.
Yeah.
Well for you. Okay. I know I answered it, but was it useful?
I do the same thing. I think I'm mindful when things aren't going well.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to either deal with it,
yeah,
or figure it out, or figure out how to deal with it. But when things are going well, I'm not thinking about the Eightfold Path at all.
Yeah.
So that's the flip side, I guess.
Yeah, and it
kind of in and out through the day, you know, as I say.
Well, and that's just how it is. A year and a half ago, you weren't in and out at all because you didn't recognize.
I was just out.
Yeah, so, but that's the point. So it's a path. It's a path to be developed. You know, it takes time. And everybody's different. You know, remember, Kandana got it at the very first teaching, and Ananda got it 45 and a half years later, a month after the Buddha died. You know, it has nothing, and that's the timing isn't important. What's most important is that we're engaged in the path. Because once we're engaged in the path and maintain the path, just like Dorothy got to the end of the yellow brick road, the end is assured. You know, there's a term that's used called a stream enterer. And it's been misapplied, meaning some a stream enterer. I mean, so the Buddha often used the analogy of awakening as crossing the stream, crossing the stream of samsara, wandering around in ignorance. So a stream enterer is someone who has got into the stream and is moving across. And usually it's applied as a kind of an advanced state. But all that it means is that we've entered the stream of the Eightfold Path, we're on that path, and as long as we maintain the path, crossing the shore is assured. It's a direct path. We know it. We can take refuge in that. We can take comfort in understanding that other human beings have done exactly this, beginning with the first human being. And he came across all of that. When you read the accounts of the Buddha's 6 years of seeking, understanding, and that final 40 days of meditation, he went through exactly that same process of kind of going in and out of mindlessness or effective or refined mindfulness, and eventually got to that point where he saw things clearly. But you have to get to that point. You have to give yourself the opportunity to do that. When we get distracted from the Eightfold Path, and it could be within modern Buddhist practice, it could be just as part of our life, it's simply that, we're off the path. So if we're off the path, we can't get to where the path leads. But it's always there. Once we've entered the stream, we can always get back on the path. When I look at the brilliance of what the Buddha developed, and you look at it as a practical system of developing full human maturity, it's brilliant. And it's rooted in meditation. And it's rooted in meditation for just what you talked about. When we sit on our cushions, we're withdrawing our senses from the distraction of the world. And we're bringing our thought process to a place of, even if it's just momentary relaxation, that we start getting glimpses of insight that leads to, wait a minute, I'm out of this now. I'm acting in a mindless way. You first have to see it. I use that analogy that Arnold Patton taught me years ago. If you're in New York and you want to get to Chicago, but you believe you're in Los Angeles, there's no way you can get there. You're too far gone. Before you want to get anywhere, you have to recognize where you are. And as far as the Eightfold Path is concerned, you have to recognize where you are in relation to the path, if you're off it or on it. So, sorry for my long-winded answer, but...
So, I don't know if this is real or not, but I've been thinking lately about how, you know, I feel like I go through these cycles of things are going well, things are not going well, things, you know, that's life. Things are going well, things are not going well, things are going well, things are not going well, things are going well. And I've also noticed that when things are not going well, then I'm, like, super mindful.
Yeah.
Really good about meditating, and I'm always paying attention to being mindful. And then things get better. And then things feel great, and then I maybe fall off the path a little bit, and then things get bad again. And I'm starting to think, well, maybe it's not that things are getting good or bad, it's that I'm getting on or off the path. And it's my outlook.
Yeah.
That's changing.
Yep.
It's really that, you know, I get very, feel things feel good, and I get really wound up, and then things, you know, subside a little bit, and they're not as good as they used to be, and that plunges me into kind of a clinging thing where I think things aren't going well, and because I'm clinging to the goodness.
And you're distracted at that point.
Yeah, yeah, right. So,
and so the ego personality is satisfied.
So my point for saying that was that if you are recognizing that you're off the path, I think that's the whole thing.
Yeah. It isn't, it for most people, I would say that when things are most difficult is when you're going to really engage in your practice. And, I mean, I know many, many, many years ago when I first started a spiritual practice, it wasn't really well focused on anything. But when things were really tough is when I really got down to the practice. And
right.
When things were good, everything was rolling along, I didn't really need much of anything. And, you know, it taught me that important lesson. How serious am I about this? Is it really just about, and I realized that,
really,
and everybody does this. But I realized that I was really using this, the modern term of spiritual materialism, it makes me feel good.
Right.
You know. But once it feels good, that's as far as I want to go. you've heard it, and I know we've all asked our question, well, what does this mean about letting go of craving and clinging? What happens when I let go of everything and it feels like annihilation? It feels like you're dying. Your ego personality is finally subsiding. And that feels like annihilation. But it really is the key. It sounds like, and it seems like to an ego personality, that there'll be nothing left and I can never enjoy my life. And you can't really understand it until you cross to the other shore. But then you realize that every moment in your life is meaningful, purposeful, and fulfilling. And there's no why about it. It's because you're fully involved in your life. It doesn't have to be an extraordinary experience to be meaningful. Then you're engaged in all factors of life, the so-called good and the so-called bad.
Right.
I was talking to someone about the power of positive thinking. Isn't it good to be positive? Well, maybe up to a certain point, but if you're so fixated on seeing everything through a positive light, you're missing at least half of life, but probably more, because life isn't positive. Life is part of the first noble truth that there's going to be unsatisfactory experiences. And true bliss comes from being able to stay present with those, the ones that aren't so enjoyable and distracting, you know, to really be focused on what's occurring. And we can't pick and choose. We have to be willing to be mindful of life when it seems unpleasant or unsatisfying, if we're going to be truly present when all the wonderful things are happening. We can't have it both ways if we're going to be mindful. Oh boy, what a great question and great discussion. Debbie, do you have any, instead of going around, we've gone around. Debbie, do you have anything you'd like to talk about or question or comment on?
Well, this is just a helpful discussion. I feel like I totally relate to everybody, you know?
Yeah.
So it's great. I don't have anything. I feel like haven't been able to come because of traveling or different things, illness, whatever. Oh. So I'm just glad to be back. It feels like a good lesson to come back to.
Yeah.
It's my birthday weekend, so I feel it's really important to me to start to be here today as part of, you know, it's a good thing being in a good place and wanting to make sure I start my year in a good way.
Yeah. Good. Well, I'm glad you're here. Welcome. Happy birthday. That's great. Kevin, how about you?
Practice is going well. this sutta maybe sort of gave me some insight into, you know, taking this whole concept internally with the, you know, the aspect of the lying, you know, or virtuous behavior, but you know, what that self-talk sort of concept, you know, what are we telling ourselves, you know, what's skillful am I, you know, each moment, you know, can be towards awakening or delusion. So, you know, you're going through mundane life, through good, bad, and you know, there's these distractions, so it's like, you know, what lie am I telling myself? Like, I have something better to do than be here, to be practicing. You know, you don't, you know, if it's a good moment, then that's more the reason to practice, just as a bad moment's the more the reason to. I mean, you know, it's not like you're seeking anything, but your great moments, you'll carry that mindfulness throughout all of them, and you know, you'll enjoy the good, the bad, but in between.
Yeah.
But what's being skillful, you know, are we really virtuous with ourselves, you know, are we really putting the effort into the practice, you know, are we getting distracted in, you know, other things, because I think that other people tend to get us distracted, you know, we tend to want to be there, be available for people in our lives to be present, but we might be being unskillful for our own practice, which, as we've said, is the most compassionate thing we can carry to everything and everywhere and every experience and everyone. So just some things I was...
Yeah, I mean, that's the essence of it, you know. What we're telling ourselves is the most important thing. And taking the time, we can't be engaged in the world in an altruistic way 100% of the time. We just can't. We need time for solitude. You know, the Buddha's a good example. I remember... excuse me. Many years ago, I read a biography of Mother Teresa. Everybody knows Mother Teresa. And up until that point, I was under the impression that 24/7 she was out there helping people. And what I found was really important to my own understanding, that she took 6 hours out of every day with her other nuns, in prayer and meditation. I don't do so much prayer, but I do a lot of meditation. So that they were prepared to do that incredible work that she did for so many years. She needed to do that first. She needed to gain that inner strength. And so meditation is our way of doing that, of keeping ourselves in fit condition so that we can really be mindfully present with others when they need us. We've got to take time for ourselves. We've got to know, you know, what we're saying to ourselves at all times. That really gets down to the heart of the matter. There was something I was going to say. Please.
This week I've been noticing the connection between your thoughts and your feelings. You know, they're just so connected.
They seem like it, yes. They seem like one thing.
Like it, yes. Good point. But I've just been noticing, you know, just how finely tuned we are to our thoughts and how connected our feelings are to our thoughts. And, you know, your feelings, your thoughts are going like this throughout the day. Your feelings are going like this throughout the day. You know, that's what we're trying to conquer, I know, but, you know, maybe just making the connection.
It is. You're describing developing right view and seeing things clearly. And you're also describing the four foundations of mindfulness. To notice the discreteness of the physical body, the feelings that arise, the thoughts that are driven by those feelings, and then it becomes kind of a recursive thing where your thoughts now start driving your feelings and they can feed on each other, but they're really two separate things. And then the final foundation, when I say at the end of meditation, notice the quality of your mind, be at peace with your mind, I'm referring to the fourth foundation of mindfulness, how that process affects the quality of our mind. And if we're able to simply feel what we feel and think what we think, like in the Vitakasanthana Sutta, you gain the ability to think what you want to think when you want to think it. That's really concentration. It's separate from our feelings. So a feeling could be something, an initial feeling of being upset because it's a normal human response to seeing something. I don't know why, I just thought about that picture of that little boy in Syria. But the thought can be separate from that. It can have a feeling of true compassion and empathy without having a reaction thought like, how could those SOBs do something like that? You know, you're just seeing a situation clearly. I'm using another kind of extreme example, but we can do that in all of our lives. We can be interacting with someone who's rather aggressive and maybe abusive, recognize that and feel the uncomfortability of being in that situation without having a reactionary thought about it. And Kevin touched on this a little bit too. The other side of desire is aversion, but it's still clinging. It's wanting something to be different than it is. And we do that with a great percentage of our lives. We create, through conditioned thinking, aversion to things that are just natural occurrences. And that creates another distraction. And it's really interesting that this conversation today was really getting down to just distraction and how it takes us out of where we are. The antidote to ongoing distraction is the Eightfold Path, resting in meditation. It's just a brilliant system for developing that.
One point that I think is important to think about that we sort of lose sight of is that you've said it before in sort of concept of this sleight of hand that's being played on ourselves. And I always think back to dependent origination, and all this happens so instantaneously. You know, P.D. Uspensky, I'm not going to get into him, but said that our centers, you know, our emotional centers and all these centers are happening at, you know, 1/10,000,000th of a second, and one's even faster and faster. I mean, this is instantaneous. It's happening. So that's how we're able to, you know, have that mindfulness. Returning to the breath breaks that instantaneous, you know.
Yep. It interrupts that conditioned response.
Because the ego self, in all these situations, the ego personality, like in an unpleasant situation, you'll react with this, or it wants to react this way, or taking more of something in a pleasant situation, you know. And it's able to morph and instantaneously always manifest itself. But this is what this practice is able to do. That we're always able to come back to that we're cultivating here, and, you know, pouring the water into the cup every day. You know, it's just, we're filling our cups.
Yeah, and developing a true presence of refined mindfulness.
It's really, really special.
It is. Let's see what Jen had to say.
Oh, I know. I didn't mean to heavy sigh. My allergies are just like, oh, it's fun.
Yeah.
Something Kevin said, and then something Laura said, and then you said refined mindfulness, and then there was this word that Matt used, samadhi, which I know you've said before.
Yeah.
I guess that's like the refined mindfulness, or like this, the kind of inner...
Samadhi means a non-distracted mind.
Okay, so I'm feeling, I've noticed this thing recently where it's almost like I have this, like two me's. One that's like very centered and saying, okay, this is the skillful thing to do. And then, but I'm still like feeling this really strong urge, this compulsion to do a different thing. So just as an example, I was at work and I have started to realize how my stress level is associated with my kind of trying to do too many things that are really not my job. And I've started to pull back and say, okay, your job is to teach. You have to be in the classroom, be present for your students, teach. And so whenever other opportunities come up in an email, most of the time it's an email, to do something that's not my job, oh, man, I just feel so compelled to do it. Or to react or to respond to the email, you know. And just like, so there's those two things. And it's very strong. No, that's not the right thing to do. It's very strong, and it's very clear, and it helps me not do it. But that urge to do it has not gone away. That's still there.
It will go away. But a self-referential ego personality, anatta,
yeah,
the five clinging aggregates, must instill itself in every thought, word, and idea that occurs to it. So the reason why you're creating such tension is that you've created an identity.
Mm-hmm.
You've instilled your ego in all these different things.
I do all the things.
And
yeah,
so it has its own distractive draw that's continual. And that's where that comes from. So when we start diminishing the need to instill our ego personality in everything and simply allow life to occur as it occurs without creating identities, then those things are no longer there. They're not existent because they're only existent in our minds. They're constructs. They're fabrications. And as we quiet our mind, as we relax our thoughts and deepen our concentration, make choices from the framework of the Eightfold Path, we cease to do that. And again, we allow ourselves to simply be at peace. It's an ego personality that does that. And I think you see that clearly.
Well, sometimes.
Yeah.
Not all the time. Sometimes I will respond to the email. That's just what happens.
Yeah.
And then I'm in a mess.
Yeah.
But the other thing I want to say was that this particular sutta was very helpful for me because I just had, on Friday, caught one of my students in two lies in one class period. Two big, like, they weren't very, it was one was I did the homework and the other one was I did an assignment, and I caught him in those lies in the same period, and I kind of let it go at the time, but I've sort of been ruminating on how to address it, and this is really helpful as a way to kind of address it with him.
Yeah,
and so it also helped me see how I reacted to him lying to me in a non-skillful way. I got frustrated,
yeah,
and irritated with him, and a little bit snarky.
Yeah, rather than understanding where it's coming from.
Right.
You know? I said that in every class I ever attended, I think. I did my homework. I never did my homework.
Because really it doesn't affect me at all if he doesn't do his homework and
yeah,
lies about it. It's not on my...
That's how I felt too.
Yeah. So why do I need to take that personally? Definitely not.
Yeah.
It's not helpful to him either, so...
But an ego will,
yeah,
you know, because it's hurt by it. It has lost control over the situation.
Mm-hmm.
People shouldn't be lying to me.
No.
Why not? people die. That's what part of the first noble truth. There's an unsatisfactory experience in life. Other people are a part of it.
I also think that it's really important to not beat yourself up around when my ego gets pulled in.
Yes.
And then just create shame and whatever, and to try to just, you know, be gentle. That's the gentleness of recognizing, and then, you know, we're going to do it. We're human.
Yeah. That's thanks, Debbie. It's so important.
Yeah.
It's one of the ways I say, be gentle with yourself. When the Buddha first described suffering, one of the things was, he would say, pain, lamentation. Lamentation is regret over something. It's a way of continually beating ourselves up. It's not helpful. It's not skillful. It'll always take us, it's always an aspect of an ego personality. You know, we're making ourselves wrong, but also building up ourselves at the same time. It's a negative focus. So thank you for bringing that up. Always be gentle with yourself. When these recognitions come up, it's not, we're fortunate that we now have a developing right view to see the things that we need to let go of and change, rather than see, well, I'm not being skillful right here. What a dummy. Well, that's not helpful. That just reinforces a behavior. But to put it back into the framework of the Eightfold Path keeps us free of that, allows us to continue to be gentle with ourselves, because we understand that it's simply part of that human condition. You know, it's all part of that first noble truth. Great class. Any other questions or comments before we finish? A few announcements. Our Dana Dinner is coming up November 22nd, the Tuesday of Thanksgiving week. There's some flyers out there and info on the website. Everyone's invited. There's a... Julie from Love and Oven asked if we could have some volunteers to set up and clean up. And we're going to take a little donation. Our Holiday Dana project is going to be collect money to give right to Julie. She's never asked for a penny for 7 dinners now. So we'd like to give her a nice contribution towards that. There's a form on the website linked on the front page that if you can volunteer or you have any questions or comments, you can just email Maura directly. She's kind of coordinating that. That's November 22nd. I'm teaching in Lambertville on Thursday nights, and that's going to end this month, and I'm going to be starting teaching in Clinton at the Hunterdon Wellness Center up on 31, beginning in November on Thursday nights at 7 o'clock. There's info on the website about that. And you know the Hunterdon Wellness Center on 31, just north of 78? It's up there. Really big, nice facility. I'll be teaching there on Thursday nights at 7 o'clock beginning in November. And I'm giving an introductory talk Friday, October 28th up there. And, excuse me, I've started a online Dhamma class, a streaming class, Wednesdays at 12 noon that you can join me if you're free and want to do that. It's been a lot of fun getting to kind of bring some of the students that have scattered around the country into the Sangha in a direct way, so that's kind of nice. I think that's it for the... Oh, and we're going to have a one-day retreat in December. I'm almost certain that it's going to be Sunday, December 4th, but I'm going to just want to run that by the Tuesday Sangha and see what they think. Do you have any feeling about that?
What day is it?
Sunday, December 4th.
But where would it be?
Here? Right here.
That's all
probably,
day?
Well, probably from 10 to 3, not a real long day, but just kind of a way to... The Tuesday night Sangha one, you know, they wanted to do something as a Sangha during the holiday season, so I thought that'd be a good way to do it.
Yeah,
so. it will either be that Sunday or the following weekend, a Saturday or Sunday. We'll, you know, to see who.
Yeah, it would be interesting.
Okay, good. I'll make that announcement next
week.
And the week after that, whatever that Tuesday and Saturday is.
Okay.
Of that week, I'm going to start the Truth of Happiness course again, like we did last year over the holidays. So that really...
Will that be in all the locations?
Yeah, we'll do the same, like we did last year, the same lesson on Tuesday as on Saturday. So if the weather's funny or you miss one class, we can take up the next
Thursday.
One.
What about Clinton? Will you do that in Clinton?
I'm thinking about it, but I don't know when I'll do it there. I want to see how that develops up there.
Okay.
You really...
Clinton, by the way.
Oh, okay,
yeah,
good.
My mom lives
really
in Clinton, and she's been talking about coming for the course.
Yeah.
Great.
So
well,
that's why I was like,
you really need, a small group of people that are that have a certain understanding
yeah.
before they can.
True.
Well, maybe not. And that's kind of the way I'm looking at it too. But I just think it'd be better if we had a small committed group before I started that.
Yeah.
Because once you get past the first 3 weeks, you're getting into somewhat conceptual applications that if you don't have the proper perspective, it's hard to really feel the use, find the usefulness in it. It's kind of like the way that Buddha never taught dependent origination until much later in his teaching, even though that's what he awakened to, because he realized that nobody had the perspective, like we did at the retreat, you know, developed the perspective to really understand how to apply it. So I think I will in Clinton, but probably not until the spring. See what develops. So yes, Debbie.
So the retreat on a Sunday that'll be here. What does that format look like?
I don't know yet. I'm putting it. Well, we'll obviously it'll start with there'll be a theme to the day, something that we loosely follow, and we'll probably start with a meditation and a talk. My feeling right now is it might be on dependent origination. But in a very direct way. I never teach anything indirect, at least I hope I don't. And Matt will hopefully be a part of it. Has Matt been around? I haven't seen. I texted him Friday. He didn't get back to me. He's around? Okay,
yeah.
Now I know.
Who's Matt?
Matt Branham, the acupuncturist. He teaches, we originally shared this place. Now he's down the street with his acupuncture, but he still teaches Tai Chi and Qigong here on Tuesdays and Thursdays. So he'll be a part of it. And he'll teach Tai Chi and Qigong, so it'll be that. If it's nice, we'll do a walking meditation on the towpath. Maura would probably lead that. And there'll be time for just discussion what we're doing here. It's not surprising. It's nice to hear. So many people that listen to the tapes comment on how much they get out of the discussions, out of our sangha here. So, and I know we all do too. So it'll be a kind of a loose, relaxed day, maybe like a little potluck lunch or something, take a little break then too, but a relaxed day just to spend together and spend in the refuge we have here. So I hope you can all join us.
Are you still thinking about 2 days in between Christmas and New Year's?
No. I'm thinking about it, but here's one of the problems I came up with, that if we all commit to it and I create a formal retreat and there's monies that have changed hands and there's deposits that can't be refunded and we get a blizzard.
The weather, yeah.
Yeah, so what I'm thinking of is if looking like, next week looks good up, I'm talking about maybe in December or January, next week looks like it's going to be nice, do an impromptu couple days up there and just see who can go.
Sure.
And then we're going to have our formal retreat or a scheduled retreat in May and October. So,
yeah.
But I'd love to be up there in the snow. And,
yeah.
As long as it's not snowing while we're driving. It's such a beautiful place. So yeah, we'll see how that works out. They're agreeable to doing that on an impromptu basis as long as the facility's open. So they should be. So I think that's it. So let's finish with the Buddha's words on metta. So find your relaxed meditative posture, and gently close your eyes and gently close your mouth. And again, take a moment to become aware of the sensation of breathing in your body. And let that mindfulness of your breath cease any distracting thoughts to the past or to the future, or that may have arisen from our talks today. And these are the Buddha's words on metta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing, in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class. Peace. Thank you for listening. For more Dhamma talks and articles, please visit crossrivermeditation.com. We rely on donations from our listeners to provide these talks. If you have found this talk helpful in developing your understanding of the Dhamma, please consider a donation at crossrivermeditation.com. This talk is copyrighted and is made available under Creative Commons 4.0 license. Please visit crossrivermeditation.com for use and distribution information. Peace.